Three women were talking in a pizza parlour in Dallas, Texas. Nothing unusual in that, you might say. But this conversation would echo all the way to the chambers of the United States Supreme Court. Its 1973 decision, in a case innocuously entitled Roe versus Wade, affirmed that abortion was a constitutional right. This case has polarized American opinion and American politics ever since. The central figure in that discussion in the pizzeria in February 1970 was Norma McCorvey, aged 23. Poor, divorced and pregnant, she wanted an abortion, but that was a crime according to the law of Texas and indeed of most states in the Union. Many of these laws were a century old, enacted mainly to protect women from backstreet abortions. But by the late 1960s, they were attacked by feminists as violating a woman's basic right to control her own body. To quote a bestseller from the Boston Women's Health Collective, entitled Our Bodies, Ourselves,
"One of our most fundamental rights as women is the right to choose whether and when to have children. Only when we're in control of that choice are we free to be all that we can be. Birth control is the single best tool for implementing this choice, but birth control methods are just not effective enough for us always to avoid unwanted pregnancy. So right now, for many of us, a second indispensable tool for taking control of our fertility is abortion."
Talk of women's rights tended to be a student and middle-class preserve. But there was another, grimmer side to abortion, noted by Shirley Chisholm, a black congresswoman from New York.
"Experience shows that pregnant women who feel they have compelling reasons for not having a baby or another baby will break the law, and even worse, risk injury and death, if they must, to get one. Abortions will not be stopped. The question becomes simply that of what kind of abortion society wants women to have. Clean, competent ones performed by licensed physicians, or septic, dangerous ones done by incompetent practitioners."
Norma McCorvey wasn't black, but like the women Shirley Chisholm spoke of, she was poor and pregnant. Her interest in an abortion was very practical. The other two women in the Dallas pizza parlor were both middle-class lawyers, keen to advance women's rights. They were seeking a test case to challenge whether the Texas anti-abortion law was constitutional. But the divide between them and Norma wasn't quite that simple, because one of the lawyers, Sarah Weddington, had her own secret story.
"My mouth still goes dry when I put myself back in those days at Austin, Texas, when my period was late. I was in my third year of law school. Each day I kept hurrying to the women's lounge between classes, hoping to find that something had happened. Each day I was disappointed."
Eventually, she and her boyfriend drove across the Texas border into Mexico. Using all her savings, she secured a successful abortion at a clinic that turned out to be clean and efficient.
"I was one of the lucky ones. Ron and I returned to Austin and plunged back into our usual routines. But the memories have always been with us."
Weddington's own experience of abortion gave a personal edge to this issue of principle. So did her difficulties in getting taken seriously by the Texas legal establishment, despite outstanding credentials. She and her colleague, Linda Coffey, took McCorvey's case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. It became known as Roe versus Wade. Henry Wade was the local district attorney in Texas who sought to uphold state law, and Jane Roe was the legal pseudonym used to cloak the identity of Norma McCorvey. As the case climbed up the legal ladder, the two young women lawyers who'd started it found themselves being elbowed aside by more senior men. But the whole point of their argument was that women had a unique perspective on abortion and that they were making a long-delayed bid for full rights. This would be undercut if a male lawyer pleaded their case before the Supreme Court. so the women lawyers and their client held the line. Sarah Weddington was 26, and it was her first appearance before the Supreme Court. Adding to the pressure was the court's tight timetable. Although each side prepares lengthy written arguments, its lawyer has only 30 minutes to present an oral argument to the nine justices. The lengthy orations of the 19th century were a thing of the past. Sarah Weddington had to touch on various issues of law and of the Constitution, and to field random questions from the justices, but she managed to get across her central point.
A pregnancy to a woman is perhaps one of the most determinative aspects of her life. It disrupts her body, it disrupts her education, it disrupts her employment, and it often disrupts her entire family life. And we feel that because of the impact on the woman, this certainly, in as far as there are any rights which are fundamental, is a matter which is of such fundamental and basic concern to the woman involved that she should be allowed to make the choice as to whether to continue or to terminate her pregnancy.
Representing Texas was Jay Floyd. In contrast to Weddington's calm, articulate presentation, he spoke slowly and often haltingly, and was also flustered by the questions. On courtroom performance alone, the case would have gone against him. In any case, the Texas statute, which dated from the 1850s, was hard to defend, allowing abortion only if the mother's life was in danger. But the justices made no decision on that round of argument. Too short because of recent resignations, they decided to rehear the case in October 1972, when fully up to strength. This time, Sarah Weddington played down women's rights and emphasised the civil rights guaranteed to each individual by the Constitution.
Well, do I get from this then that your case depends partly on the proposition that the fetus has no constitutional rights?
It depends on saying that the woman has a fundamental constitutional right, and that the state has not proved any compelling interest for regulation in the area. Even if the court, at some point, determined the fetus to be entitled to constitutional protection, you would still get back to the weighing of one life against another.
That's what's involved in this case, weighing one life against another.
Weddington had slipped up, giving Byron White, one of the conservative justices, an opening. But she quickly recovered.
No, Your Honor. I say that would be what would be involved, if the facts were different, and the state could prove that there were a person for the constitutional right.
Well, if it were established that an unborn fetus is a person with the protection of the 14th Amendment, you would have an almost impossible case, would you not?
I would have a very difficult case.
This time, her opposing counsel was Robert Flowers. He declared,
"It is the position of the state of Texas that upon conception, we have a human being, a person, within the concept of the Constitution of the United States, and that of Texas also."
Now, how should that question be decided? Is it a legal question, a constitutional question, a medical question, a philosophical question, or a religious question, or what is it?
Your Honor, we feel that is, could be, best decided by a legislature, in view of the fact that they can bring before it the medical testimony, the actual people who do the research. But we do have...
So then it's basically a medical question.
From a constitutional standpoint, no, sir. I think it's fairly and squarely before this court. We don't envy the court for having to make this decision.
Fair comment. The Supreme Court was faced with an unenviable task. The two rounds of legal argument had set out many of the essential issues around which debate still revolves today, such as a woman's right to control her body versus the right of the unborn child, and the question of when, during a pregnancy, the fetus should be considered a person. In January 1973, the court finally delivered its verdict. By 7-2, the justices, all male, upheld the appeal of Jane Roe and declared that the Texas anti-abortion statute was unconstitutional. But the court also went much further, setting out a framework for abortion by dividing pregnancies into three equal trimesters. In the first third of a pregnancy, a woman needed only the consent of her doctor, but in the later two-thirds, the state's interest in the potential life allowed it to impose ever tighter regulation over abortion. The decision on Roe versus Wade was doubly controversial. The court was adjudicating on an issue of enormous moral and religious sensitivity, and it was also doing so via debatable legal reasoning. The majority decision had been written by Justice Harry Blackmun, a recent appointee for whom this was his major drafting task. Blackmun, by general consent, didn't do a very good job. He found it hard to get to the essentials and spent too much time on medical rather than constitutional issues. Two justices dissented from both the decision and the reasoning, Byron White and William Rehnquist. They weren't against some kinds of abortion, particularly when the health of the mother or of the fetus was in doubt, but they opposed what seemed to them abortion on demand. As White put it in an angry dissent in another abortion case.
At the heart of the controversy in these cases are those reoccurring pregnancies that pose no danger whatsoever to the life or health of the mother, but are, nevertheless, unwanted for any one or more of a variety of reasons. Convenience, family planning, economics, dislike of children, the embarrassment of illegitimacy, etc.
White believed the court had gone far beyond its authority in such a broad reading of the 14th Amendment of 1868. This had been intended to secure full and equal rights of U.S. citizenship for former slaves.
I find nothing in the language or history of the Constitution to support the court's judgment. The court simply fashions and announces a new constitutional right for pregnant mothers and, with scarcely any reason or authority for its action, invests that right with sufficient substance to override most existing state abortion statutes. As an exercise of raw judicial power, the court perhaps has authority to do what it does today. But in my view, its judgment is an improvident and extravagant exercise of the power of judicial review that the Constitution extends to this court.
Roe versus Wade in 1973 cast a long shadow. The Supreme Court's decision became a fault line in American society, around which the arguments for and against abortion would polarize, pro-choice versus pro-life. And, as we shall see, it became the centerpiece of the new Christian rights campaign to bring God back into politics and to reverse the rights revolution. So millions of Americans applauded Roe versus Wade for making abortion constitutional. But for millions more, it seemed like a constitutional abortion.